least 50 people have been killed and dozens more injured in a blast targeting a Shiite mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. Iran says it's ready to help Lebanon overcome its economic crisis, including its severe fuel shortages. In Bahrain, regime forces clash with people protesting against the normalization of ties with Israel and the opening of its embassy in Manama. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bahram Sanjafi. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with Afghanistan, dozens of people have been killed and scores more wounded in a bomb explosion targeting a Shiite mosque in the northern city of Kunduz. The locals say the blast occurred as worshippers were offering Friday prayers. Medical sources have confirmed more than 50 deaths. They fear the death toll could rise as hospitals are receiving more bodies. A Taliban official has described the blast as a suicide attack. There has been no way to claim a responsibility. However, the Daesh terrorist group has repeatedly targeted the Shia community across Afghanistan. Iranian Foreign Ministry has condemned the incident as an act of terror, expressing sympathy with the families of the victims. For the latest on this deadly incident, let's cross over to Kabul, the Afghan capital. Amin Alami is there. Amin, what do you have for us?
Well, Behrouz, Syedabad inside the city of Kunduz in northern Afghanistan is considered as a Shia-dominated area where this huge bomb blast happened. According to local sources, the residents of Syedabad and even some of my own close friends who are the residents of this area in Kunduz city, a terrorist has detonated his explosive belt inside a mosque where hundreds of worshippers have gathered to offer the Juma prayers. In the meantime, Taliban officials both there in northern Kunduz city and here in the Afghan capital Kabul say that it was a suicide attack, and they indirectly blamed the Daesh terrorist group for being behind launching such brutal attack against civilians, mainly Shia worshippers who have already been repeatedly targeted by Daesh terrorist group, not only in northern Afghanistan, but exactly here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, many times. But in the meantime, the Daesh terrorist group has not commented regarding to this specific incident in northern Afghanistan. But as facts on the ground shows, the Daesh terrorist group is after re-emerging in this country and considering itself as a big rival for the Taliban. Unconfirmed reports show that the terrorist group has nominated many key figures of the group, including its key military commanders, as the governors and district leaders of the so-called Islamic State of the Daesh here in Afghanistan. However, such moves by the Daesh comes as the Taliban has said that given the Daesh terrorist group suffers from having a public support inside the Afghan society, and in the meantime, the Taliban forces are traditionally against the Daesh terrorist group because they believe that they are foreign fighters or foreign invaders who are after waging further war in Afghanistan under the name of jihad, under the name of Islamic values. But in fact, what the Taliban says is that the only power that can stand against the Daesh terrorist group and eliminate it in Afghanistan are the fighters of the Taliban. That is why they say that given we have strong equipped fighters who have well experiences of clash with the Daesh terrorist group, mainly in eastern Afghanistan, the Taliban group says we are enough capable to uproot this terrorist group inside Afghanistan. But only time will tell if the Taliban will be able to strongly pound the Daesh here in Afghanistan and does not let this terrorist group to turn into a big headache for the Taliban inside Afghanistan.
Thanks for that, Amin Alami in Kabul. The Iranian Foreign Minister says his country will expand ties with Lebanon and is ready to help the Arab country overcome its economic crisis.
while respecting the independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of Lebanon, and within the framework of relations between the two countries, we are prepared to help and cooperate with the Lebanese government in order to enable Lebanon overcome the economic difficulties.
Amir Abdullahian also said that Iran is ready to send more fuel shipments to Lebanon. He noted that the U.S. economic war on regional countries will not succeed. The Iranian foreign minister added that talks between Tehran and Riyadh to restore ties are on the right track, but more time is needed. The top diplomat was speaking with reporters in Beirut following his meeting with the Secretary General of Hezbollah's resistance movement. During that meeting, Said Hassan Nasrallah said that Iran has proved it's an honest ally and a reliable partner during crisis times. Amir Abdullahian also held talks with top Lebanese officials, including President Michel Aoun. Well, breaking news, right on time. We're just talking about Daesh maybe being responsible for that mosque explosion in Afghanistan. And Daesh has claimed responsibility for that mosque attack in northeastern Afghanistan in Kunduz. More than 50 people getting killed there, and fears that the toll could rise. We'll definitely have an update for you shortly. Now, Bahraini regime forces have clashed with people protesting against the normalization of ties with Israel and the opening of its embassy in the capital, Manama. Protests turned violent after troops used tear gas and smoke bombs against the ralliers who were marching on the Israeli embassy. Anti-Israel sentiments run high in the Persian Gulf, and has been running high since Tel Aviv opened its embassy during a visit by Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Manama last Thursday. The country's main opposition group, Al-Wafaq, and the kingdom's top cleric, Sheikh Isa Qassem, have already slammed the move. Bahrain is one of the four Arab states that normalized relations with Israel last year under Washington broker deal. Palestinians have called it a step in their back. The UN Human Rights Council is facing mounting criticism after it voted to drop its probe into war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. The Qatar Institute for Human Rights Studies described the vote as a blatant attempt by Riyadh and its allies to ensure blanket impunity for themselves. The Institute says the move will lead to more violence and suffering in Yemen. Independent rights organization in Yemen reacted to the Mawatana Organization for Human Rights says that the measure amounts to a green light for continuing the campaign of death and destruction in Yemen. The UN top rights body ended its probe into war crimes in Yemen on Thursday. The decision has already drawn strong criticism from some countries and other rights bodies.
The United Nations Human Rights Council has voted against renewing the body's mandate for investigating possible war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Members narrowly voted to reject a motion brought by countries including the Netherlands and Canada to give UN investigators another 2 years to monitor atrocities in Yemen. It marked the first time in the Council's 15-year history that a resolution was defeated. Ahead of the vote, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said there was no peace in sight in Yemen and that urgent funding was needed to avert large-scale famine there. Meanwhile, the Dutch ambassador called the vote a major setback, adding that the council failed the Yemeni people and cut their lifeline to the international community. Rights activists had previously warned that Riyadh was heavily lobbying against the resolution in a blatant attempt to ensure blanket impunity for crimes and other violations of international law in Yemen. They also accused the UNHRC of bowing to Saudi pressure and putting politics before principle. Experts believe the council has lost its credibility by shutting down the investigation. This is not the first time Saudi Arabia has used what many call arm twisting to stop the UN from scrutinizing the Yemen war. Back in 2016, Saudi Arabia was removed from the UN's list of children's rights violators after Riyadh threatened to cut off crucial funding to the world body. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has claimed tens of thousands of lives and displaced millions, resulting in what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The coalition, which is logistically and militarily supported by the West, especially the US and the UK, has repeatedly bombed schools, hospitals, and other civilian facilities during its 7-year onslaught. The United Nations has in the past been criticized for its inaction against Riyadh, But the latest move by the Human Rights Council seems like giving a green light to Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies to continue their atrocities against impoverished Yemen with impunity.
Time now for the news review section. Israeli forces have prevented Palestinian worshippers from reaching the Al-Aqsa Mosque for dawn prayers, and that, according to Palestinian media, the worshippers reportedly chanted slogans pledging to defend Al-Aqsa. They were prevented ahead of a general mobilization called by Palestinians at the mosque later on Friday. The Palestinians are outraged at an Israeli court ruling in favor of a Jewish man who prayed quietly at the mosque. The court on Wednesday ruled that the man had not violated the law. The Islamic Waqf that oversees Al-Aqsa called the ruling a flagrant violation of the compound's sanctity. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation blasted the ruling too. Egypt called it a violation, expressing concerns about the consequences. Jordan says the ruling is an attack on the mosque. Now let's see what our guests feel about this. So we'll have Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto. Also joining us will be Mick Napier with the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Toronto. Zafar, you heard reactions from organizations and also a number of Islamic states. What's your response to this? How do you describe that?
Well, the Israeli attempt through a court ruling is another example of this creeping annexation of Palestinian lands, and in particular Jerusalem, and within it Masjid al-Aqsa, which is the third holiest shrine in Islam. We need to keep in mind that the Israeli court has actually no jurisdiction whatsoever over Masjid al-Aqsa, and that this ruling that the Israeli court has given will open the way for illegal Zionist settlers and other aggressive Zionists to barge onto Masjid al-Aqsa. We need to keep in mind that the Jewish people already pray at the what is referred to as the Western Wall. And more than 100 years ago, Muslims had actually permitted the Jewish people to pray there. Prior to that, they were forbidden to pray over there. And now we can see that they are moving beyond the Western Wall. They are moving into Masjid al-Aqsa. And it is absolutely clear that the Zionists have a plan to physically take over Masjid al-Aqsa. They have made no secret of this, at least the fanatical amongst them. Yet they have the backing of the Israeli state machinery, the police, the military, the regime itself, and the courts to allow this creeping annexation so that the Zionists could destroy Masjid al-Aqsa and build what they refer to as the Third Temple. It's a very serious issue, and not only for the Palestinians, but for the entire Muslim world that must take it seriously and serve notice on the Zionists that this kind of illegal activities will not be tolerated.
Now let me turn to Edinburgh and ask Mick Napier. Mick, a mosque, as it's known, it's a Muslim place of worship, like a church is a Christian place of worship. So what is this all about? Is this not aimed at Judaizing even the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in addition to Al-Quds?
I think you know the answer to that. The Zionists wish to take over control 100% of Palestine. They've made this very clear. And to expel as many Palestinians as they possibly can. Nothing in the body of work written by Zionists, their behavior over the last 100 years, nothing suggests that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is to be exempt from the Zionist expulsion of Palestinians and their takeover of the land. They want it all, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque is no exception. These people, this so-called Temple Mount Faithful and various other similar groups, they march through Jerusalem every year chanting the Al-Aqsa Mosque will be burned down. And there have been constant attempts, as your other speaker mentions, encroachment on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. In 2000, of course, people probably not remember that Ariel Sharon sparked the Second Intifada by invading the courtyard of the Al-Aqsa Mosque with like 1,000 or so soldiers and police, paramilitary police. And a flagrant provocation. 4 years ago, the Israelis built steel gates around the Al-Aqsa Mosque which Palestinians were supposed to be allowed through under strict Israeli control, even more than the existing situation. And by tremendous resistance, the Palestinians managed to have those walls, those steel gates and walls removed, because the international pressure on Israel mounted because of their resistance, their determination. So there is a history of encroachment. The Temple Mount faithful and their people want to take over the entire compound. And the idea that the Israeli Supreme or the Israeli court would allow these people to carry out quiet prayer is preposterous. They are going to invade the area. They are going to be as noisy as they wish to be. They are going to humiliate Palestinians who cross their path. And they've already published a timetable of daily events in the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which they'll be carrying out. Look, the whole history of Israel, the whole history of the Zionists in Palestine, has been that they first of all demand, when they're weak, equality with the Palestinians. When they're strong enough, they expel the Palestinians. We see this in terms of where Jews can live, where Palestinians can live. Jews can live in 94% of Palestine today, Palestinians in 6%, and that's not the end of the story. So this is something which will go on and on and on. There is no limit to Israeli appetites in this situation. And really, now that we've seen Saudi Arabia, and not Saudi openly, but it's coming, and Morocco and Egypt and the Emirates establish these links, open embassies with Israel, what are they going to do in this situation? They can ignore the killing of Palestinians, which they are. They can send tourists from the wealthy Gulf states to Palestine while Palestinians are being brutally repressed in the vicinity. But will they allow the Al-Aqsa Mosque to be taken over by the Zionist authorities? I think the answer so far isn't clear, but certainly the populations of these countries, the people of these countries, will find it very difficult to accept.
Okay, we have to leave it there. Let me thank our guests. We had Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought in Toronto, and Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
When the U.S. government allows exploitative real estate corporations to develop shoddy private developments to maximize profits and displace black residents, thousands are left without homes during a disaster, says Rashad Robinson, reporter, in an article titled Hurricane Ida is proof U.S. systematic racism aggravates effects of climate crisis. Stay tuned for more. With nearly 2 months left of this year's turbulent hurricane season, thousands of Louisianans are entering their sixth straight week without power following Hurricane Ida. Meanwhile, displaced residents in search of adequate shelter for their families are piling into any neighbors' homes that are still intact, some with up to 10 people in a single white trailer, destroying more of Louisiana's power grid than any other storm in the state's history. Hurricane Ida has left millions without homes or access to clean water during a pandemic. This destruction wasn't by simple happenstance or some sort of unpredictable anomaly. It was the direct result of the failure of political and corporate leaders in the U.S. year after year to build adequate infrastructure, implement equitable protections for relief, and provide black communities the same resources and protections afforded to wealthy white neighborhoods. We have seen this before, 16 years ago, nearly to the day when Hurricane Katrina decimated Louisiana. The U.S. government and corporations provided no support that the people of New Orleans needed as delays in relief and rescue left millions of residents without food, water, or shelter for weeks and severely undermined the economic stability of residents in the years since. Color of Change, the organization have led for last 11 years, was founded in 2005 in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. It was born in response to a profound realization in that moment. No one in power was nervous about disappearing black people and failing to meet the needs, not even that massive scale of suffering. There was no consequences for hurting black communities. Now, 16 years later, black people have built the kind of power that it takes to be heard. As a result of the work of the Movement for Racial Justice, we can now see how racial impact is more and more frequently part of the policy discussion when it comes to the problems Americans need to solve as a country. From climate disasters and a pandemic, to consumer protections, to tax and education policy. But being a topic of conversation, whether in a government office or a corporate boardroom, is not enough. Americans do not yet have the power it takes to get the results they need when it comes to preventing events like Ida or COVID-19 from causing them more harm and forcing more sacrifices from them than other communities. When U.S. government allows exploitative real estate corporations to develop shoddy private developments to maximize profit and displace black residents, thousands are left without homes during a disaster. When elected leaders redirect vital infrastructure and health funds to already bloated, inept, and abusive police departments, health and emergency services cannot reach those in need during times of crises. Even with widespread organizing for reinvestment into black communities, corporations actively disrupt movements for collective power and change. Climate change and structural racism share something profound. They are both outcomes that corporations and politicians have manufactured for their own narrow purposes and profits. They also bring out the worst of corporate myth-making. Corporate leaders have pushed the sham of individual consumption reduction as the main solution to climate change, while it's apparent that reckless corporate overproduction, inefficiency, and willful neglect of responsibility, including an extensive history of exploiting black people is the greatest contributor to climate change. Conservatives, including corporate leaders, have similarly tried to convince black people that racism is a matter of individual behavior rather than policies, systems, and structures designed to maintain white supremacy and privilege. Climate change and structural racism reinforce one another. Each makes the other stronger. We need to accept that racism is a climate change accelerator and that climate change is a major racial impact and racial justice issue. And in both cases, unchecked corporate power is the biggest driver. Climate disasters aren't a simple misfortune. Their destruction derives from geographic segregation, generational poverty, and a lack of accountability from corporate powers and elected leaders who have siphoned resources from black communities from the start. Historic and current political decisions have placed black people directly in the initial zone of climate danger. From consistent faults in the emergency protocols in New Orleans, unlivable air quality for majority black neighborhoods in Detroit produced by Chrysler production plans, investing funds to police departments, and giving tax breaks to corporations. Environmental racism is the direct result of those in power intentionally choosing to prioritize profits over the well-being of black communities. Corporations that have the means to ensure housing and substantial recovery for survivors of disaster but choose to do nothing are attacking black communities, no matter what their slick advertisements featuring black people may say. To understand the impact of climate change and refuse to implement legislative regulations to hold its impact is another form of attack on black communities. As individuals around the U.S. are showing up for survivors via fundraising, mutual aid, and neighborly support in action from corporate powers and harmful policies implemented by lawmakers have led to New York City, one of the wealthiest cities in the world, being entirely unprepared for mass flooding in subway systems and homes as a result of Hurricane Ida. Both private corporations and public elected officials have a responsibility not only to provide the necessary relief, but to prevent this kind of negligence from causing more damage in the future. Last year, corporations of all kinds publicly claimed to care about racial justice. But the fact is, moments like these let us know which corporations are actually willing to put their money where their values are. Energy providers like Entergy and hospitality companies like Hyatt have an opportunity to uphold their commitments to justice and directly help those displaced in Louisiana. If they claim to care about black lives, they too must support black livelihood and well-being. Forcing black communities to bear the brunt of climate disasters disproportionately is not only unjust, but will only postpone the moment at which we realize that climate change is an issue that affects Americans all and will drastically impact their shared fate.
We get people.
U.S. deportation of Haitians.
In
The U.S. government has deported thousands of Haitian refugee seekers back to their crisis-hit country. The United States' inhumane treatment of Haitian asylum seekers and migrants involves policies designed to deter specific nationality from entering the country put in place decades earlier. Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I am your host, Danny Arya. In this episode, we will investigate the U.S. government's hatred towards Haitians, which is part and parcel of the anti-migrant and xenophobic strategy culminating at the southern border with Mexico, where for years, thousands of refugee seekers have been stranded before being sent away. Thank you for joining us.
There is not enough food to give to everybody who is inside there. We need to get out of the camp to look for food. Things are worse.
It is these pictures of border patrol agents on horseback pushing migrants into the river that have caused so much anger. For some, they carry the echoes of the worst chapters of American history.
What we witness takes us back hundreds of years. What we witnessed was worse than what we witnessed in slavery. Cowboys with their reins again whipping black people, Haitians, into the water.
The recent mass migration of Haitians was in part caused by a magnitude 7.2 earthquake, as well as tropical storms that affected the entire impoverished nation. The July assassination of President Jovenel Moïse further exasperated violence and instability in the Caribbean country.
Disregarding the human suffering, the Biden administration has already deported thousands of migrants, according to official estimates. Now, that comes on top of the thousands of others deported in previous administrations, including the 12,000 Haitian migrants indefinitely detained in Guantanamo in the 1990s. We're now joined by Dr. Adrienne Pine, a professor of anthropology at American University. She's also an author, and her latest book is titled Asylum for Sale, Profit and Protest in the Migration Industry. Thank you for joining us, Professor.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, ma'am, first of all, what is the fact that the U.S. is deporting Haitian refugee seekers back say about Washington's claims of promoting human rights across the globe?
You know, it's particularly ironic that there's talk of sending Haitians to Guantanamo Bay, which, of course, Haitians were kept at an offshore really concentration camp in Guantanamo Bay in the early 1990s during the crisis following the U.S.'s support of the ousting, the coup against Aristide in Haiti. And but what's ironic is this is, Guantanamo is in Cuba. It's land that the United States has not returned to the nation of Cuba, and it's a site where the worst human rights violations that one can imagine are carried out. And meanwhile, the United States has been hemming and hawing about the supposed violations of human rights that Cuba is committing. And it really is mind-boggling to think that the United States claims itself to be a promoter of human rights and is punishing other countries and is issuing sanctions against other countries that are starving their populations and, you know, harming their health in the middle of a pandemic, when in fact the United States is doing things that are far, far worse. This represents a huge threat to the people of Haiti, which is, you know, really sort of piling on top of so many other insults and injuries that the United States has committed through coups, through acts of violence, and against Haitians in Haiti, and now by violating international refugee law by preventing Haitians, denying them their right to seek asylum in the country they choose. It's really, really outrageous.
Thank you, ma'am. Professor Adrienne Pine there joining us.
The United States' brutal deportation of Haitian migrants and refugee seekers is wreaking havoc not just among human rights advocates, but also within the American public. President Biden won the Democratic nominee as well as the presidential election by claims of supporting human rights and promoting liberal values.
Yet the mass deportation effort is laying bare the depth of U.S. disregard for those claims under his administration. Refugee and asylum seekers often embark on a lengthy journey to get to America. Many recount being kidnapped several times and released only after paying drug cartels a hefty ransom. To get a better perspective, we've also invited Mr. Kim Ives, an independent filmmaker and commentator. He's also editor at Haiti Liberté. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Ives, given profound instability in the Caribbean nation, how do you think the fate of the refugee seekers is going to pan out?
Well, they appear to be letting some refugees come into the U.S. to try to blunt the outcry, both national and international, against the treatment the Haitians have been receiving. But they are still sending flights. These past few days, they have been sending 4 or 5 flights a day of Haitians back to Haiti. But this may end up being a huge miscalculation on this part, because right now there is a revolution brewing in Haiti. Haiti's huge underclass, the lumpen proletariat of Haiti, is being forged into a force of resistance right now by an alliance of armed neighborhood groups who the bourgeoisie of Haiti used to give guns to settle their scores and fight their political battles.
Thank you for joining us, Mr. Kim Ives, here on We the People.
Corrupted authorities and criminals extort migrants every chance they get in countries on the way, such as Mexico. Many officials, cartels, and criminals are making a fortune by exploiting those seeking a better chance to live.
Nosotros los haitianos que viajan a pie, que coge todo lucha para llegar aquí, que gasta muchos dineros y ellos llegan aquí. Nosotros se piden al gobierno que se apoyamos a nosotros, que dan papeles, porque algunos de nosotros, si encuentran papeles, puede empezar a trabajar, puede ganar plata, puede ganar una vida mejor. Después ellos pueden pensar a ir a otro país, pero como ellos no tienen ni papeles, no nada, ellos querían viajar al frontera de Texas.
There are still continuous reports of illegal crossings, detentions, and even murder and sexual abuse in regards to the migrants. Many of the migrants intend to join their loved ones on the other side of the border through Texas's Rio Grande Valley, the busiest corridor for illegal crossings. What is the difference in the way this administration handles immigration compared to the previous one?
The Biden administration is continuing the Trump administration policies, not only with respect to Haiti, and I could say all of Latin America, where it's keeping in place the sanctions against Haiti's neighbor Cuba, where it's keeping in place the war on Venezuela, where it's keeping in place the backing, or kept in place, the backing of President Jovenel Moïse up until his assassination. So on the border, it's the same thing. They are continuing, as I mentioned earlier, the metering, the Title 42, the keeping people at bay, and the verbiage of making things more humane and more more humane is all that they've stepped up. But as for the actual policies, no, they're essentially the same as the Trump administration policies.
The exclusionary policy against migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers, particularly those from Haiti, has a long history, and the Biden administration's course is just a continuation of brutal U.S. strategy. Today, Haitians are being whipped away from U.S. borders, reviving images of black people being whipped in cotton fields by white men on horseback.
The images coming out of encampment along the Del Rio International Bridge in Texas are not only heartbreaking, but also a telltale of how much Washington cares about human rights and suffering. The U.S., meanwhile, employs the human rights excuse mostly to intervene in the internal affairs of other nations.
You know, the refugees who are currently being deported in violation of their international right to seek asylum using Title 42, which is a racist policy implemented by Trump's advisor, Stephen Miller, that the Biden administration has decided to continue using. Under that, these deportations, the Haitians who are being deported to Haiti are really going to be facing dire circumstances. A large number of them have actually been out of the country for around a decade since the 2010 earthquake in Haiti that, you know, as we know, killed hundreds of thousands of people. People fled. They went all over the Americas, large community in Brazil, in Peru. And many of those Haitians have residency in those countries. They actually have lives that they could go back to and that wouldn't be necessarily, you know, not what they're seeking, as they are seeking to come to the United States, but they would be better than what they face in Haiti, which is a country that is politically and, you know, really otherwise infrastructurally devastated.
Now, whether Haitians are entering through the southern border or trying to get to Florida's shores by boat, what is clear is that the Biden administration does not intend on helping Haitians who are themselves victims of U.S. policies in Central America and the Caribbean. While President Biden needs to be held accountable, the administration has to respond why.
Well, the former special envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, essentially said that he didn't have a voice in this administration. He said that he was ignored. He also said he didn't want to be connected to what he saw as cruel and inhumane policies. He said that it was wrong to be deporting Haitians back to Haiti because that island nation is facing a number of crises, including the aftermath and political turmoil of the assassination of the president, as well as an earthquake that hit the country last week. I want to read part of Daniel Foote's letter because it was a blistering letter. It said in part, "I will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees. The collapsed state," and he's referring to Haiti, "is unable to provide security or basic services, or more refugees will fuel further desperation and crime." So there he is saying that Haiti is actually being harmed by us sending back, the United States sending back Haitian migrants.
The so-called illegal aliens are desperate human beings escaping violence, poverty, and mafia. They had left Haiti in the hopes of fleeing persecution or seeking a better life. Yet now they face an uncertain future, hanging somewhere in the middle of a game played by the most powerful men in America.
The U.S. Special Envoy Daniel Foote has resigned in a blistering letter that he sent to the State Department, saying it was inhumane what they were doing, and basically decried the U.S. policy of sending people back into Haiti when it is in complete crisis following the July 7th assassination of President Jovenel Moise, the August 14th earthquake, the August 16th tropical storm. The country is totally reeling underneath economic and financial crisis, and so sending these people back is just the height of cruelty, and at the same time, the U.S. is receiving 95,000 Afghan refugees. Why can't it receive a few Haitian refugees and asylum seekers as well?
The U.S. policies towards migrants has also created a crisis for Mexico. Mexico's border cities are not equipped to house, feed, and protect tens of thousands of refugees. Many of the cases of migrants forced to remain in Mexico ended with deportation orders from judges because they failed to show up for their immigration court hearing on the U.S. side of the border.
Immigration has always been essential to America. Let's end our exhausting war over immigration. For more than 30 years, politicians have talked about immigration reform, and we've done nothing about it. It's time to fix it. On day one of my presidency, I kept my commitment to send a comprehensive immigration bill to the United States Congress. If you believe we need to secure the border, pass it, because it has a lot of money for high-tech border security. If you believe in a pathway to citizenship, pass it. There's over 11 million undocumented folks, the vast majority of here, overstaying visas. Pass it. We can actually, if you actually want to solve a problem.
Despite all the baseless promises, the immigrants have had to stay in places such as the Mexican state of Tamaulipas, In such places, rape, torture, and kidnapping are so pervasive that the U.S. State Department itself has a do not travel advisory on.
Making a calculus here, he's thinking about which American publics matter more. It really has to do with internal politics. There's a large number of people in the United States who are very anti-migration and very anti-migrant, and he's trying to appear tough on crime, whatever the cost, including the cost being the lives of and well-being of Haitian asylum seekers. And, you know, then there are, of course, large numbers of people who care about human rights. And, you know, I think the problem is that that human rights aren't negotiable. This should not be a domestic political issue, which is really what it is. Biden is just sort of following the electoral winds and thinking, you know, that that, you know, the Democratic Party might lose in the next elections in Miami or Texas because they're letting in all of these, you know, Haitian immigrants. But that's not the issue here. I mean, that, you know, I believe that regardless of what the, you know, what the majority of the American people think, and I actually don't know how that would break down. It would depend on how you'd ask the question, but I think we do believe ourselves to be a nation that respects human rights.
Now the Haitian migrants, they take on a deeply harrowing journey in brutal temperatures of up to 40 degrees centigrade. While in Mexico, many of the asylum seekers are targeted by criminal gangs and drug cartels. Many children are sexually abused or employed for dangerous crimes. The dire conditions of the Haitian migrants are definitely going to worsen as they are deported away from the U.S. amid silence by many politicians and top U.S. decision makers.
As many as 80% of migrants have been victimized, according to reports by human rights organizations. Emboldened by U.S. anti-migration attitude, bandits of violent drug and people smuggling gangs find no reason to show mercy to the victims.
Well, I think the world has been witnessing one of the great human rights travesties this past weeks as the situation at the border continues to worsen. Already, we know that the Biden administration has kept wholesale most of the Trump administration's policies, such as metering. This is where they have to, where immigrants can't come into the U.S. to ask asylum. They have to wait in another country, like Mexico, usually in squalid camps, and get a number and wait for their number to arrive, which can be months, even years.
The embarrassing treatment of Haitians today comes in the backdrop of at least 4 years of Republican zero-tolerance agenda to block the southern border in order to make it more difficult for the migrants to enter the United States. Former President Trump was notorious in his anti-migrant and xenophobic policies, which he kept promoting with backing from the GOP base.
We will build a great wall along the southern border. And Mexico will pay for the wall. On day one, we will begin working on an impenetrable, physical, tall, powerful, beautiful southern border wall. After meeting with their wonderful, wonderful president today, I really believe they want to solve this problem along with us, and I'm sure they will.
With a Democratic government in power in the White House, many rights activists expected the situation to change, but to no avail. The massive crackdown on migration puts on display the core ideologies in Washington in favor of cracking down on victims arriving at U.S. borders rather than helping them. The Trump administration was notorious for exercising zero tolerance at the U.S. border with Mexico. So, what is the difference between the Trump administration and the current one in terms of dealing with migration at the southern border?
You know, we're really seeing very little difference at all. And this is not surprising to those of us who know Biden's history. He, in fact, as vice president to Obama, they really started up the incarceration, the levels of immigrant detention that we're seeing now. And that hasn't been reduced. But more importantly, as I mentioned, Title 42, which is an explicitly racist, xenophobic policy that was really floated by Stephen Miller even before the pandemic, Stephen Miller being the racist advisor to President Trump, it was floated as a way to prevent brown and black people from coming into the United States. The pandemic gave them the perfect excuse to say that migrants pose a public health risk.
Please stay tuned for more.
Denying migrants a chance to seek asylum is indeed at the heart of America's policies. This is while many of the victims find themselves under these conditions due to decades of U.S. intervention in countries such as Haiti, as well as others in Central and Southern America. With images of Haitians' expulsion going viral, politicians from both sides of the aisle are taking the chance to take advantage of the heated power play over immigration.
It is essentially broken down along the lines that we've seen in recent years with the election of Donald Trump. We have an extremely xenophobic and reactionary part of the American population, which sees immigrants or has swallowed the lie that immigrants are the cause of their misfortune and their growing poverty and their growing lack of services. And yet there is, I could say, a growing percentage of the population, which is not only black or brown or engaged on a level that has them understand these dynamics, but they are in fact in solidarity and understand that the plight of immigrants from Haiti and from the rest of Latin America, for that matter, is the same as their own. So I think there has been an outpouring of outrage and solidarity and indignation at what they're seeing happening on the border. The pictures, again, of the border agents on their horses, just like in the days of slavery, a century and a half ago, it has recalled these images, and people are saying, enough is enough. We cannot treat people like this.
Now, Republicans say that Joe Biden was the one who led Haitians to believe that they could seek asylum in America, as Democrats express outrage. Fate of the victims, meanwhile, matters to no one. Here at We the People, we wish all migrants well, no matter where they are, and pray for their safety and well-being. Well, that was our show, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Make sure you join us next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.